This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So today what I'd like to do is really talk about Fragile X-associated disorders, and specifically among women. Because in my mind, and everybody's who care for families with Fragile X, that the women, the premutation carrier women, are the center of the family. They are typically the primary caretakers of their children, as well as the older relatives in their family. And they make sure that they get through the day with their complications and challenges, and then they make sure that everybody else gets through the day and really reach their potential. So I'm going to focus on the women. I'm going to go a bit from a historical point of view, because it's kind of fun to do that. And I'll kind of go back and forth, but I'll take the historical point of view just to show you how the whole story unfolded of where we got to premutation carriers. Okay, so let me start in the late 1800s. So at that point, they noticed, or this is a particular clinician, Johnson, noticed in 1897 that there was an excess of males in institutions for those with intellectual disabilities compared to females. And this was then, it was a very strong observation. And then in 1938 was by Lionel Penrose, a great epidemiologist and clinician. And he had a famous Colchester study where he went through the institutions there and again saw this same phenomenon, excess of males compared to females. And he had two reasons for this. One, he said that there's really not very high expectations for females. And so nobody's really watching out to see if they're excelling or not excelling or what they're doing. So that was his first. And the second one, which I hope is more viable and important, is that perhaps the males are more aggressive and have more disruptive behavior, so they're more often institutionalized than the females. So at that time, he thought it was an ascertainment bias, and that's the way it sat in the literature for a while, until people started seeing that they looked at the family patterns of inheritance and saw, again, an excess of males being affected with intellectual disabilities compared to the females. So then there did seem to be at least a familial clustering of the males. But it wasn't until 69 that Lurkey finally said, you know, maybe there's a reason, a biological reason for this, and that it's really due to the X chromosome genes, and so that there's linkage to the X chromosome, and so because the mutation is on those chromosomes, then you're going to see that masked mutation in males, and it will be masked in females. So he was the first one that really suggested that there could be a biological phenomenon to this excess, and then the story went on where they decided, okay, let's look at these families that do have excess males and find other markers. So, because this is at the time, there was just a huge heterogeneous group of individuals with intellectual disabilities, even the males themselves. So the next marker that was found was a macroorchidism, so large testes, and this was in the 70s. And I love this orchidometer. This is so very kind of the measurement was very soft. I'm trying to think of the right word, crude. But, I mean, it was just like, I think it's about here, you know. And so you really, it was a physical exam. And those larger volumes we had to add on to this orchidometer. That's not the typical. The colored volumes are what's usually there. But for the individuals in some of these families, they really did have enlarged testes, so much so that that it was a very marked phenotype. So again, the idea of being able to segregate out this group of males that had both excess males in their family and then this particular marker was really helpful in trying to further characterize a subgroup of individuals. And then in 69, and then from that point up to 77 or so, the first cytogenetic marker came available. So this was the original pedigree by Herbert Lubbs, and the individuals you can see with this double line are marked with, they had a marker, what he called a marker, at the end of the X chromosome. So here's the proband, and you can see that those that had intellectual disabilities, these four people, had this particular cytogenetic marker. So this is the X chromosome, and in the culture that they did, they had an excess of chromosomes that had this particular marker. So again, another marker that could segregate the families. And once that was done, then they could start to ask important epidemiological questions. So what's the prevalence of individuals with this marker? And this was just a chromosome spread. And again, the assay was just doing a culture of the chromosomes and then characterizing the number of cells that had this particular marker. From those studies, they found out that this marker X, which then became to be called Fragile X syndrome, was the most common inherited form of intellectual and developmental disabilities. That marker turned out to be not so good. There was a lot of false positives, so the estimates of the prevalence were not so good at that point, but they got better when the gene was identified. But irrespective, this allowed you to then say, okay, let me take all the guys with macroorchidism and this particular cytogenetic diagnostic tool, this marker, and then look at them as a group and really see how do we characterize them? Or can we characterize them? Are they unique? And the first thing to note, and I put females here because there are affected females, the first thing to note is really they're not very distinguishable, right? They have a very subtle phenotype, and it's not until you get them in a group can you begin to say, okay, there's, you know, the long face, a more square jaw, larger protruding ears. So the somatic phenotype is very subtle. But there, and here's a beautiful series of one boy. He was diagnosed at this age, like 3 to 4, I think it was. But again, at birth, you would never pick up a child that you would anticipate would have problems, right, from the somatic features. The males in particular, they have strengths and weaknesses when it comes to cognition. They have significant deficits in working memory, in attention, in executive function. They have language delays, and they have an atypical verbal language pattern of perseveration. Their full-scale IQs, for whatever that is measuring, is somewhere in the 40s, 50s typically, though there is a broad range. And females, more broad because of that extra X chromosome that's, you know, masking the effect. But you can see from profound intellectual disability to almost no disability at all among females. Again, once the cytogenetic marker was found, as Randi was saying, you could start looking at the inheritance pattern, knowing that it was on the X chromosome. You had a particular pattern that you expected, and that is that 50% of the offspring from mothers would receive the mutation. And then, again, from the fathers who were carriers, and that was very unique at the time, all the daughters would be would receive the mutation and none of the sons. So the pattern didn't look like that so much. It was unique compared to what the expectation was for just an X-linked syndrome. And as Randi said, there was anticipation. So what you saw was increased frequency of those with the syndrome in the younger generations compared to the older generations. You saw this interesting guy in the pedigree who ended up transmitting it to his descendants. And so that was we called them transmitting males at the time because they were very unique for an X-linked disorder. They carried some mutation. We thought it was the mutation, but they expressed none of the symptoms. So again, X-linked, but with this layered complication in these particular inherited families. So in 91, and the gene was found, and several groups were collaborating and realized that they were coming up with the same phenomenon. And this is just a sketch, not to scale or anything, but what I want to show is that, so in the 5' untranslated region of this gene, this FMR1 gene, standing for Fragile X mental retardation gene. And that's an interesting story, too, because at the time, because it looked, you know, the Fragile X is a wrong term, right? There is no breakage of that X chromosome. In the culture, you have to have very special conditions to stress that cell in order for that chromosome to break. And in this case, it's a depletion of folic acid. But it's not a natural occurrence, so you don't just look at the cells and see this happening. You have to stress that thing out in order to see this marker. But at the time, we thought that perhaps there really was a breakage. And so hence the name Fragile X and FMR1, thinking that it might be one of those contiguous gene syndromes that you've disrupted several genes in that area. And so this was identified as the first of that series. But we were all wrong. I mean, it turns out to be the gene, and it's not a contiguous gene syndrome. Okay, so what was found is in the 5' untranslated region of the gene is the CGG repeat. And the next step was trying to characterize the different people in the pedigree, and so I'm just showing that line. And so originally we called these individuals pre-mutation because they weren't showing symptoms of Fragile X syndrome, and full mutation because it was being fully expressed with the intellectual disabilities. We found that with every generation, this particular repeat expanded. And finally it expanded to what then we realized was over 200 repeats. Those 200 repeats would become methylated and silence the gene. So it was then found out that the full mutation, or the mutation that leads to Fragile X syndrome, was due to the silencing of this gene, and it did not make the product, and the product's just labeled as Fragile X mental retardation protein, or FMRP. So once it was characterized of what the mutation was, we could go back to the families and really understand more about the expansion and why we were seeing this anticipation. So this anticipation, it was named as such initially by that same guy, Lionel Penrose. His idea was that this was really an ascertainment bias in families, so that when you diagnose this individual, for example, if you say you diagnose this individual, then these relatives or parents of the next generation are much more surveillant of their offspring. So he suggested that it's not that it appears more often, but it's diagnosed more often. So that with each succeeding generation, you're much more aware that this might be present. So that's why he called it anticipation of that symptoms or those symptoms occurring. This turned out to be certainly anticipation, but due to a biological underpinning. So the expansion of the CGGs to the full mutation depends on the gender of the parent and on the repeat size in that parent. So if I just start at the top of this pedigree as an example, in blue is the normal allele with, on average, the highest frequency of these alleles are between 29 and 30 repeats. And in red is the what we call the pre-mutation. So this woman seldom, because of the law, a small repeat will expand to the full mutation. And if you look at some of the other people in this example pedigree, you can see that one time it went to the full mutation, one it went up slightly, expanded, and another it expanded too, but a little bit more. So each oocyte has a little bit of a different expansion rate. So now this woman has 68 repeats, so it's higher than hers, and so again, it'll go up. It'll expand at a higher risk. And then similarly here, for a man who has 72 repeats, it can go higher or it can contract. The main thing is it usually doesn't have the same magnitude of expansion. And so that explained why we never saw affected daughters with the full mutation from these transmitting males, that for some reason this was not expanding to the full mutation, but then once it was in a female, it passed on. So the gender risk is being a female carrier and passed, because it only expands through the female to the full mutation, and the size of the repeat. So the larger the repeat, the higher the risk to go to the full mutation. So if I just look at, if we just characterize what the clinical definitions are of these different allele categories, allele being defined by the number of repeats, these clinical definitions are based on the expansion risk to the full mutation. So the common alleles are the most frequent, are those under 44 repeats. Those in the intermediate, or sometimes you have a gray zone, are labeled here. Pre-mutation, usually defined as 50, well, not usually in the clinical arena, 55 to 200 unmethylated repeats. And then, as I said, over 200 repeats methylated is the definition of the full mutation. I've put some very rough estimates of what the carrier frequencies are of these different classes. This ranges from, for example, in females, which I'll be focusing on, from about 1 in 100 to about 1 in 200 or 300. So good studies are coming out, and it will be interesting to see what they are and how they vary in different populations. In males, again, the data are much more limited, but about 1 in 400 to 1 in 800, so much. Among full mutation carriers and some of the screening tests, but this varies. So I put about a conservative estimate of full mutation carriers, which is equal in males and females, so about 1 in 4,000. And then if we go down to the full mutation, what's the frequency of that? Again, all those males that carry the full mutation have some significant problems. So manifest the Fragile X syndrome, though there's variation, and then some proportion of the females are diagnosed with the full mutation, given that they have the premutation. So identification of factors that are involved in that instability. I mean, why does that mutation occur, and why does it expand? We know something about it. We know some of the risk factors, but not a lot. These studies originally came from population-based studies. I was just going to show some sperm studies really characterizing the repeat size in men who had particular repeat structures. Model systems now are coming to the fruition. And I'll just talk a little bit about family studies, because this is a study that we're involved in together that we published together as a collaboration. So many of you probably already know this, but this repeat that I said is CGG here implied that it's a pure repeat is not a pure repeat. It's interrupted by AGGs at a particular pattern, and what I've shown here is the most common allele in the Caucasian population, 9+9+9. The initial mutation seems to be the loss of these AGGs, so that this repeat structure is more unstable than this one, and this repeat structure, which is a pure CGG repeat, seems to be more stable than that one. So this is now the beautiful work that Flora started in terms of being able to characterize the repeat structure where you can actually do it at a relatively good price. So you could do it in a large scale. Led us to be able to do a collaboration where we had 464 transmissions from parent to child, and look at the repeat structure and look at the outcome of in terms of stability. So here, let me just show you. So this is the percentage of alleles that were stable from mother to child, and here's the repeat size listed here, and here's those again that from parent to child were unstable, again same repeat sizes listed here, and the color is down here. So this denotes the number of AGGs within that CGG repeat. So the blue is no AGG, so they have pure repeats. And you can see that blue color is much more frequent among the unstable alleles compared to the stable. And then if you go along the rest, you can see, again, that the red are much more common here than here, et cetera, et cetera. So the fewer the repeats, the greater the chance of instability, and that bears out also from males to females. Again, you can see just standing back that the blue is much more common among the unstable transmissions from father to child compared to those with stable. So really cool data, and really definitively saying that repeat structure is very important in terms of that initial mutation that leads to instability. Now, the second stage of expanding to the full mutation, there's still a lot more research that has to be done to understand that process. But at least I think we know quite a bit about the first one and what the risk factors are. I'm just going to do one introduction to what one mechanism is for this, the slippage for the small repeat changes, just to give you an idea of what might be going on. So this is during replication. So this is a replication slippage model. And the idea is that the polymerase and the helicase can work in conjunction when they're going through this replication process and laying down the next strand. when they hit the repeat sequence, I'm sorry, so here's the repeat sequence. When they hit the repeat sequence, these tend to, the polymerase tends to slow down, and so this becomes less coordinated in terms of its ability to replicate. And so what happens is that in order to rectify that process, this will loop out. And it's a stable structure with that repeat and forms a hairpin. And then, again, it catches up and everything starts to take off again. And now you have this extra DNA sitting there. So from that point on, you then, in order to get an expansion, you have to incorporate this loop into the strand, right, to have an expansion. And those depend on properties like whether it's on the leading strand or whether that's loop on the lagging strand. It depends on, it seems very much from the mouse model anyway, to depend on having the mismatch repair proteins there and active. So again, we're making progress, or the field's making progress, and to understand this expansion mechanism, but still a lot to learn. Okay, so let's go back to the full mutation. As I said, or the Fragile X is the most common inherited form of intellectual and developmental disabilities. It's due to the silencing of the FMR1 gene and the consequent absence of the protein. And I'll just very quickly, because I'm sure all of you know, this is repeat for you, but we know now that the FMRP does many jobs, and this is one. It regulates the translation of proteins that are important for synaptic function. And so here I've just shown a scenario in terms of the function. So in this scenario, in synapse function, the FMRP is important in synaptic maturation and axonal guidance in experiential learning. And so, for example, here in this post-dendritic cartoon here with... when mGluR receptor is stimulated by glutamate, it leads to the translation of local proteins in the synaptosome. That local translation, or the local proteins, then cause the AMPA receptor to be internalized, and that internalization of AMPA then is involved in long-term synaptic plasticity, right? So that, and the FMRP then controls that local translation by suppressing translation until the stimulation signal comes across. So when FMRP is not there, you have uncontrolled protein synthesis, you have a greater internalization of the AMPA receptors, and so this weakens the synapse. So that's one theory, and then Brandi and her group are involved in clinical trials that are looking at downstream effects in order to correct this situation. And again, with the idea that you can lead to really balancing the system again and strengthening those synapses. So that's all I'm going to say about the full mutation, but just to give you an idea that it's an exciting time in terms of being able to really consider targeted treatment for full mutation carriers. Okay, so let's go back to the pedigree and think about this woman. So Randi mentioned the Dunk Island meeting in 85. In 87, Randi and the National Fragile X Foundation were very put together and this has continued, one of the best meetings that there is in the Fragile X field, and that's when the families and the scientists and the clinicians all get together and talk and think about where are the gaps, what's the next thing that we need to do. So I remember this specifically because we're in a room and we're talking to women about family planning and what kinds of contraceptive they can use and what options they have in terms of family building the way they want to. And one woman said, "Well, wait, this is after like an hour of in a panel and talking very seriously." Okay, so a woman raised her hand and said, "I've already gone through menopause. Anyway, I'm in my 30s. This has nothing to do with me." And then another woman said, "Well, me too. I've already gone through menopause." And it was just then the conversation took off about having menopause early on and how wonderful that is. You know, we're through this. So Amy Chronister did the first good survey out there to try to say, is this really true? At the time, the gene was not identified. So what she found, indeed, among obligate carriers, that there was an increased frequency of ovarian failure. This just goes to show that, exemplifies, once the gene was identified, so we knew they were obligate carriers, but then we found out that that really it was not all obligate carriers, it was only pre-mutation carriers. So here just labeled that this, for example, I have trouble with having children, IVF, another one having trouble with children, or having children. And even when these data first came out, I think we were all a bit skeptical, because at that time, again, we thought the pre-mutation, there would be no outcome of the pre-mutation. Because that repeat, again, I'm just going to reiterate this, is not in the coding region. It's not in the protein itself. It's in the 5' untranslated region. So we knew the protein was fine. And it was really a conundrum of why would it be restricted to the pre-mutation carriers and not the full mutation carriers. But indeed, that was the case. So this is now called Fragile X-associated primary ovarian insufficiency, or FAXPOI is what people say. So on average, primary ovarian failure occurs in 1% of the general population. And it's just a clinical definition of cessation of menses prior to age 40. Among pre-mutation carriers, then it's shifted by about 5 years down, so that about 15% of women who carry the pre-mutation go through menopause prior to the age of 40. So, as I said, these women were quite excited that they got the whole thing over with early on. But really, what are the clinical consequences? Well, first of all, even among women who are cycling, they do have altered cycle traits, and they have indicators of low ovarian reserve, which I'll show in a second. But there's significant reproductive outcomes, and that's subfertility, and those who go in for IVF treatment are less responsive to hormone stimulation. So there is a group of those women who really their reproductive life is impacted. Here's just one indicator of ovarian reserve. This is anti-Müllerian hormone on this axis, which is a very good early marker of ovarian reserve. And this is the age at the blood draw, and red is carriers and blue is non-carriers. And you can see, so a low AMH means a low ovarian reserve. And you can see even among the young women that they already have indications of a low ovarian reserve, even though they're still cycling. What we want to do and are trying to propose at this point is to go lower and really look at this section of the curve to see when does this ovarian dysfunction begin. So if we look at the natural number of eggs that a woman has through her lifetime, you know, during her fetal life, she has about 7 million. There's this huge wave of atresia around birth, so it drops to about 2 million. And then you can see by puberty, you have about 300,000 follicles that you're ready to go through each cycle being recruited. Transition state means that at this point you begin to go through menopausal transition and cycle alteration. And so there's about a 13-year position from this or time frame from having about 25,000 follicles down to having 1,000, which then everything shuts down. So it could be two things going on with FAXPOI. We know there's a reduction 5 years. The first hypothesis could be that, in fact, at development, there's just a lower oocyte pool. The second is that, in fact, there could be an increased rate of follicle loss at some time along that curve, so that they have the same number of eggs, but either they, around puberty, they start to go through atresia at a much faster rate, or at some point, here's transition is just shown. So what we're trying to do is a good cross-sectional study to try to find that change point, and if it's this hypothesis, or see if it's a parallel line with that hypothesis. We've also tried to look at some risk factors that would help predict which women are going to have problems and which women are not. As I said, only 20% or 15% go through FAXPOI. And so this is just one study where we combined our data with those in Nijmegen. And what I've shown here is a hazard ratio for premature ovarian failure, again, having cessation of menses before age 40. And we started with repeat size. And what we find here, you can see here's the repeat size on the x-axis and the risk or the hazards ratio on the y-axis. And this is the point estimates with the 95% confidence limits around it. So you can see that around 65 to about 90 repeats, they have the highest risk for this particular phenotype, which is quite fascinating because it's higher than those who have even higher repeats from that point on into the hundreds. So trying to understand this phenomenon is very important. So it's a nonlinear association with repeat size. Other factors that we were looking at are listed here, and what we found are these two also are predictive of increased risk. Smoking, not a synergistic effect, just don't smoke. You know, that's it. All women who smoke have about a one-year reduction in age at menopause, so just don't smoke. And these women, if they're compromised already, are going to reduce it down. Also, the mean age at menopause in first-degree relatives. In other words, there's a familial component to age at menopause, and that's well known now, and they're making a lot of headway to define those genes that are involved in age at menopause. So both these factors were important. And so we just, you know, here what I've shown is just a scenario of a high-risk woman and a low-risk woman. A high-risk having 8 repeats, she smokes. The mean age of the menopause in her female relatives is about 38, compared to a woman low risk, 50 repeats, never smoked, and then a high, you know, kind of a more typical mean age at menopause. So you can see, if I draw the line at this clinical definition of ovarian failure, that this scenario of women has about a 30% chance. I'm sorry, this is essentially a survival curve with the probability of going through menopause at this point, based on the age. So about a 30% chance of having ovarian failure early on, and this woman having a very small chance. So at least we're starting to chip away at understanding some of the risk factors. Important because there's significant health outcomes that come with estrogen deficiency. So going through menopause very early increases your exposure to prolonged estrogen deficiency. We know from other types of ovarian insufficiency, there's a psychological well-being is diminished. There's other disorders related to that estrogen deficiency. And it's been noted that osteoporosis is true among these women. But the cardiovascular and the other potential medical consequences of lack of estrogen have not been well characterized among these women, so a lot of work to do there, as well as other endocrine factors. And again, at this point, there's at least specific for FaxPoi, there's no proven treatment for fertility or preservation methods. So there's a lot more to do in that. And then, because of your group here, Randy and Louise and all of you started to think about, hear the women complaining about their fathers and their uncles, that they were starting to fall more. They were having to be placed in homes because of cognitive decline. And so in 2001, I think it was the first paper that you guys put out to show that there indeed was a very significant neurodegenerative disorder that's associated with the premutation, especially in men. This became to be called FACTAS, or Frederick-Associated Tremor Ataxia Syndrome. And I'll just show this quick video, and you've probably seen videos. I feel like I'm here telling you everything you know through it. So this is just a picture of, this is our neurologist that works with us, Jorge Juncos. And just you can just see the problem in the gait. So significant ataxia. They show this guy because he's around in his mid-50s, so he has significant attention tremor, and now he's quite debilitated since that time. So this is a very serious disorder. How does it play out in women? In men, it's about a lifetime prevalence of about 30 to 40%. Is that what you would say, Randy, about or higher, about lifetime risk?
It can go up with age.
Well, yeah, it definitely goes up with age, yeah.
40%.
In females, it's lower, not insignificant. I think originally we thought it could be insignificant, but this is not insignificant for a neurodegenerative disorder. The severity might be milder. The one question are there different symptoms that manifest in a female but are really parallel to the FaxTAS in men? And I've just listed some here that have seemed to be more prevalent among females. They have similar neurological findings. And here's an excerpt or a diagram from Flores' recent paper showing that they have the kind of the hallmark of this is sort of the internuclear inclusions in neurons and astrocytes that you can see in these different staining here. And some proportion of the women also have specific MRI findings that you find in males with FACS-AS global brain atrophy, white matter disease, and these particular middle cerebellar peduncles that light up here. And again, this is actually a male, but similar findings among the women who've been diagnosed with FACS-AS. What are the predictors of the risk? Man, I don't think we know much at all. Repeat size, I think early on in men, it was said that maybe having greater than 70 gives a significant increased risk, but whether that's linear or non-linear, I'm not sure there's enough data at this point to say. It seems like there for females that if you have a skewed X inactivation ratio, you might have an increased risk, at least in some papers. If you have other comorbid neurological conditions, for example, we have a woman who has very severely affected as a pre-mutation carrier, but she also has Parkinson's in her family. So she's got a double hit, perhaps. You noted, Flora, that there is more dementia in these women and whether or more indications of significant dementia on the MRIs, right? Or histopathological findings. And so it could be that you have to have another hit to really exacerbate the situation in females. Okay, so what is going on with these premutation-associated disorders? Here I've just, again, a schematic to represent non-carriers and their DNA, their mRNA and fMRP, if we say that's baseline, and here I'm showing males. In the premutation, what I didn't talk about is that actually there is an increased level of mRNA, FMR1 mRNA that's produced, and a decreased amount of fMRP. And again, this is some of Flora's original work. In full mutation carriers, again, it's silenced. So the Fragile X mutation is specifically due to the absence of fMRP. And FACS-AS is due to, probably at least in part, and a great part, to an RNA toxic effect. So two different mechanisms. In females, again, they have this normal allele. Because they're on X chromosome, they're really mosaics, right? So one cell will shut down one X, and another cell will shut down another X. So they're really mosaics. Normals will have this size of repeat, say the normal allele. There'll be a mixture of in the cells of having a normal normal MR transcript, and increased frequency of these transcripts in cells, and again mosaic in terms of the level of fMRP, and similarly for full mutations. So Fragile X syndrome is due again to the reduction of the fMRP in females. And it is associated with X inactivation ratio. So there is a correlation with the more skewed, the higher on average, the higher symptoms that you have among carriers. Premutation carriers. FACS has, at least in some case, in some papers, seems to be associated with the X inactivation ratio. Not a lot of studies done on this because there's really not a lot of studies done on FACS-AS in women. FACSPOI is not associated with X inactivation ratio. That's either due to the fact that we're using just blood, and so it's the wrong tissue. You know, we need to be doing ovaries. Or it's really telling us something that the toxic effect is occurring at a time when both X's are active. So at this point, we don't know. Fragile-associated disorders are now clearly there's three established. One gene mutation due to the expansion of the CGG, at least two different mutational mechanisms that we know about. FACS-AS, when you think about it, is a developmental disorder due to the absence of the fMRP. FACSPOI, we don't know. FACS-TAS, again, it's at least we know that there is an mRNA toxic effect, and it seems to be a late onset disorder. But there's, among females, a lot more manifestation of symptoms that occur. And there's a lot of literature that's showing that, you know, ADHD, depression, whatever, all these that I've listed, and whether these are also consequences of, for example, could these be due to consequences of reduced FMRP? Could these be due to FACS-TAS and the neurological vulnerability? Could the estrogen deficiency cause some of these disorders? So it's unknown at this point. So there could be environmental factors. There could be modifying genes. So we decided at one point to try to study this to see, you know, what we could find out in terms of the manifestation of the disorder. So we did a study. We call it the Easel-Emery study of adult learning. We did the general population because we wanted to actually look at intermediate size. So we pulled carriers and intermediates from the general population, and intermediate carriers from the general population, and then pre-mutation carriers from Fragile X families. This is the age. That was the restriction of English, just because we were doing a whole series of psychological instruments. Protocol is we screened with a medical history, and that was screened to find out who could take the neuropsychological test battery, and then we got a sample for diagnosis. Just here are some of our sample sizes, just to show you the non-carrier, intermediate, and pre-mutation carrier in terms of numbers of females. And we had to take care of things like mean age, because you can see that among these three groups, there's a difference. Ethnicity, that since we were drawing from the general population, primarily in Atlanta, Georgia, there's a higher frequency of African Americans in the general population compared to the families that we picked up on. That's not to say that there's a lower frequency, but just who was participating in these families. Income varied, as well as ascertainment. Where they were coming from. So those were our confounders that we needed to take care of. At the time when we started the study, we really had no idea which area, which domain we needed to understand or to test. So we did a very broad neuropsychological test battery, and I think that's a limitation of our study. But here I've just put just the general domains: attention, executive function, memory, and general intelligence. And you can see the various tests that we used to do this. So all this is showing is we did, because we had so many variables, we did a principal components analysis to try to reduce those, I can't remember, something like 21 variables down to some manageable outcome measures. So we had seven factors that pulled from this battery. So for example, and then we could name them. So visual processing and memory, they were based on these tests. Self-report and attention were primarily based on the car. So you can see these blacked areas are just showing which domains were part of that particular factor that we labeled them. So we had these seven outcomes that we could test with the asking about repeat sizes. Did we see any difference between those three allele groups? So to make a very long story short, and just to try to focus on the only one that we found had a significant difference between non-carriers, carriers, and pre-mutation carriers, and here are the estimates with the 95% confidence limits around it. These are adjusted mean factor scores. I mean, the scale means nothing because these are factor scores from a principal component. But we found that this was, after adjustment of the number of tests, was significant. If we go back to this thing, we realize that that one domain, or that one factor, sorry, was completely based on the Conners. So we took the Conners and we separated out the four domains that are part of that. And the only one that wasn't significant was the hyperactivity and restlessness. Inattention and memory, impulsivity and emotional liability, and problems with self-concept were all significantly different between carriers and non-carriers. We also did an kind of an opportunistic analysis of our screener that we had, because we went through and asked about medical conditions in order to really understand, you know, were they eligible for the neuropsych test. So here's the kind of the general medical conditions that we asked about, and you can see in this one. Here I've shown the frequency of those medical conditions among non-carriers and carriers, and here's the adjusted adjusted odds ratio, adjusting for all those variables that I spoke of before. So the only thing that was significant after adjustment was something very curious, was allergies. There was a reduction of the frequency of allergy. You know, hate when these things come out. It's like, so we just ignored it, right? And I'll show you because we saw this finding here, we decided to look further into our various questions that we were asking, and saw that really this aspect was being driven by ADHD, a reporting of ADHD being more frequent among non-carriers, among pre-mutation carriers, compared to non-carriers. In the neurological issues, here were the different questions we were asking about, and we saw significance, again, after adjustment, for learning disabilities. And the only other thing that we saw significance for was lifestyle, where we saw that there was more alcohol use among carriers versus non-carriers, and all I can say is good for them. You know, self-medication sometimes is a very good thing. Okay, so follow-up studies. We then wanted to ask, are there any modifying factors? So we took the lifestyle and asked, okay, in the analysis that we did, if we adjust for smoking and alcohol use, or if we look for these, do we see anything? And we didn't see any difference. We looked at the important thing of raising a child with Fragile X in terms of these outcome measures like depression, anxiety. We didn't find anything. But then we saw, well, let's try to look at a condition to FACSPOI, where they were in their reproductive stage. So this was a very rough estimate of where they were in their reproductive stage and the age, and whether they were, if they had POF or not, premature ovarian failure. And so and then looking at these different categories. These are the adjusted odds ratio with both of these in the model. So both of these asking if they predict some of these outcomes. And the only one that we saw that had an indicator that FACSPOI might be playing a role were these mental health disorders, and that was combining depression and anxiety. As you see here, these were the two that we looked at, not ADHD, had no effect of where they were in the reproductive stage. And then in thyroid problems. So that was a significant contributor, but there was no interaction terms that we saw. So another study we did to try to ask about other modifying genes, we looked at ADHD in the family and saw that indeed there was evidence of clustering, so there's more ADHD in the families where the premutation had ADHD, so clearly there had to be background genes that were predisposing. In terms of these characters, what I just showed you, the depression, anxiety, and decreased verbal IQ, which I didn't show you, we saw that they were influenced by the reproductive stage, and so therefore by aspects of FACSPOI. And as I said, we saw no association with having raised a child with Fragile X on depression and anxiety. That could be because we were using a very, very crude measure, right? We just asked, did you raise a child? We didn't ask, did your child have significant behavioral problems? How many children did you have? So I want to say that this was crude. And we know from the literature that stress really impacts depression and anxiety as a risk factor for the two. So that's known. So we thought, well, okay, let's back up. Let's look at this again. Let's take stress as raising a child with Fragile X syndrome as a stressor, and then see if we could find the subset of women who might be more vulnerable to these effects of stress. Now, this was very opportunistic because in our department, there's a strong group of people that look at stress, right, and childhood trauma. So we had a nice opportunity to look at this potential phenomenon. So the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis is responsible for the endogenous stress response. So corticotropin hormone is released from the hypothalamus in response to stress. That, in turn, leads to activation and release of adrenal corticotropin hormone from the pituitary gland, and that, again, in turn, leads to the synthesis and release of cortisol from the adrenal glands. Okay? We know that from studies that the persistent hyperactivity of this HPA axis is mediated by this particular corticotropin hormone releasing receptor. And we know from this group that we've been working with, that variation in this particular gene seems to be interacting, so it seems to be an effect modifier of stress, and that leads to a predicted outcome under certain haplotypes or certain genotypes of decreased mental health. So we thought, okay, let's use this same phenomenon and test this hypothesis, again, with stress being raising a child with Fragile X syndrome, and look at the corticotropin releasing factor receptor 1 variation and ask about those outcomes that we saw. So here's the model. The outcome were these, that so a measure of depression, of anxiety, of social phobia, and of affect. And the predictors were variation in this particular gene, raising a child with Fragile X, the interaction of those two terms, and then the fMRI repeat group, the size, and other covariates. I think that I list the other covariates, a ton of them. So we had to take into account these other covariates. And here's the population that we did it in. So here is the number of repeats broken down by their allele category. And here, importantly, is to show the variation in the percentage of women who had a child with Fragile X. Of course, among these women, there is none. But you can see about 44% for the low premutation carriers, and then about two-thirds of the women with the higher premutation carriers had a child with Fragile X. Okay, so what did we find? We found that the main effects, so variation in the gene, or raising a child with Fragile X, or fMR1 group, did not affect this outcome. Okay, so they were not. So we had no main effects. We did find that the interaction between this gene and the raising a child had a significant association with social phobia. And so here are some of the details of that. So here is just, this is, I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. So this is, these are the different SNPs that we looked at, so the different variants that we looked at within this particular gene. And I just highlighted the ones that we genotyped. And you can see that what's significant is this particular SNP after we adjusted for the number of tests that we did, including the number of outcomes and the number of SNPs. So this was driving our interaction term. And here's what it looks like. So I have to say, this is very preliminary, because I almost don't believe in gene-environment interactions if you don't have main effects. And the only way you can pick them up is if they do this cross. If they do a cross. You know, it's exactly what this is doing. This is. So what we did find was, this is the various genotypes, the three possible genotypes at this particular variant. This is the mean social phobia scale from the SPAI. So a higher is worse. This line shows that with increasing number of T alleles in the genotype, you have an increased frequency of women with a higher, on average, score compared to those without raising a child with Fragile X, and you can see that actually it seems protective. Very preliminary, very interesting. We've been trying to go and do follow-up studies where we're doing much more with not just saying, did you raise a child with Fragile X? We're now trying to use the ABC or the Urban Behavioral Checklist on the kids, having the parents filled out to see, you know, what are... what is the behavioral disorders in that child, and does that correlate with as a stressor, as well as looking at other aspects of stress. And it's held so far. And the stressors that are most important from these surveys are those related to the child. So the behavioral problems in the child and the financial and stress associated with the child with the disability. So a lot more to do, and again, I want you guys to take that with a grain of salt because it's the first study we've done, and the measure was crude, as I said, and there's more to really look at. So let me end by saying that my heart goes out to these women. They have a lot on their plate, and they themselves have challenges with some of their own symptoms, and then again in the family. And I'm all I have to say is I'm so impressed with these women, and it's an honor to work with them. And you learn a lot. So let me just really quickly, this is all a big team, and I didn't even mention everybody, but Emily Allen, I need to highlight, she is our statistician for many of the studies and the person who really pulls all the data together, along with Jessica Hunter, who did all the cortisol studies. All these other people are the ones doing the testing and phlebotomy. Jeannie Vasutzik, many of you know, is a clinician who runs the Fragile X Clinic, and we get some of her families through her. Joe Kubels and Laura Adriana are the ones who, we grabbed onto, who do a lot of the stress work. Our clinical psychologist, and I think I mentioned Jorge, who's our neurologist. And as I said, the families, none of this work could be done without this extraordinary effort that the families provide and help us with. So thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.